London Defiant today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Londoners remain unbowed after Saturday night's terror attack.
If me having a gin and tonic with my friends, flirting with handsome men, hanging out with brilliant women is what offends these people so much, I'm going to do it more, not less.
Plus, President Trump weighs in on the attacks via Twitter, but many national security jobs in his administration are still vacant. So the burden's on a few career civil servants.
The strain that they are under, given some of the behavior and tweets by our president, is certainly one that over time will begin to have long-term consequences.
And remembering a 1984 film called Supergirl.
Is this a feminist movie? Is this a feminist character? In the same way that you're seeing happening now with this Wonder Woman movie.
That's all ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. That was the dramatic moment in a London pub on Saturday night as police officers ordered patrons to lie down and shelter in place. One of several scenes of violence two nights ago in the British capital. We're going to spend the first part of the show today on that attack in central London on Saturday night, including a question of self-reflection. Have the media spent too much time talking about it? We'll also hear from a London surgeon who says he doesn't go out as much as he used to with colleagues most nights, just in case something happens and he has to get back to work in the ER. Seven people were killed on Saturday night's attack, and several dozen other people were wounded. First, the attackers drove a van down London Bridge, running over pedestrians. Then they got out and ran into the bustling Borough Market area, where they stabbed people indiscriminately. The World's Leo Hornack went there earlier today.
I'd say, you know, there's kind of shocked, saddened, and slightly nervous mood. I mean, I'm just looking across, and I can see hundreds of commuters walking across the bridge to the station from the city, which is the main financial centre. It's a pretty normal scene, you know, people just going about their business. But when you speak to people, it's the first thing they're speaking about. And when you look a bit closer, you also see that some things aren't as normal. I mean, one thing, for example, is obviously huge areas of the streets around here are still cordoned off with forensic tape. But there's other little things. I mean, it's the extra police officers. It's the flowers that are everywhere. As I walked over the bridge myself, there was a group of priests just standing there offering people, if they wanted to talk about things or sort of have a more spiritual outlook on things, they were there to provide some kind of support.
Leo, talk a bit more about police presence today. Compare it to the bump in police that you saw right after that attack in front of Westminster.
Right. Well, I would say it looks pretty similar. I mean, where I am right now, as I say, there's forensic tape, because it's actually a crime scene, so that's a little bit different. But often in areas that aren't major tourist areas or aren't obvious targets, I'm seeing a lot more police just walking around, patrolling. Even in the suburban neighbourhood I live in, you see police walking two by two on the streets. I mean, that's very anecdotal, but that gives you an indication of the fact that just so many more police are ready at the moment for this kind of incident.
Well, the police made at least a dozen arrests in East London yesterday. They've carried out more raids today.
Right.
Are Londoners happy or concerned by this large police presence?
Well, this is where, for the first time, if you like, politics has broken out on this issue. The previous two attacks we've had recently, the Ariana Grande suicide bomb and before that the attack just by Parliament, all the sort of political players stood together and they said, you know, this is terrible and we support the police. This is a tragedy and we stand firm. This time, for the first time, that's not really happening. What you're getting is the government saying, we're doing everything we can, but we need more investigative powers. And you're getting the opposition saying, hang on a minute, we've had huge cuts in the numbers of police numbers in the last 8 years, ever since the financial crash. And this is the reason, according to the opposition, why these attacks are so hard to defend against. And part of that case against the government is the fact that it seems in this incident and in some of the other incidents, the perpetrators were known to the authorities. In this attack, we're already getting reports that people had phoned terrorist hotlines, people in the community, to say, I'm concerned about this guy. You can see why some people are saying, do we actually have the manpower to actually act on all of these tips? But the bigger thing, really, Marco, is how the country as a whole is feeling. In just a short few months, we've had three attacks in this country, and that's something different. And that makes this attack really, I think, feels different. Because, I mean, you can't keep having a minute's silence every month. And so that's a really big question of how do you deal with this when it becomes the new normal? At the same time, ordinary Londoners are just trying to adjust and think about how we carry on with a higher level of risk than we're used to and how we adjust to that. I mean, one of the people the BBC spoke to was Richard Angel, and he was actually an eyewitness to the attack itself. Have a listen to this.
I keep saying, if me having a gin and tonic with my friends, flirting with handsome men, hanging out with brilliant women is what offends these people so much, I'm going to do it more, not less. Because that's what makes London so great. That's what makes it the best city in the world. And we're going to go out and enjoy it more. I'm more determined than ever to love the city that looks after me.
A really strong message of resilience there from one Londoner. I'm sure that's duplicated many, many times over.
Indeed. When I've been speaking to people around these streets, that's the sort of defiance you've been hearing. But I would say, I wonder how many more attacks can a city go through before people start to actually alter their habits? I don't know the answer to that, and I'm sure it'll differ person by person, but it's now the question we're beginning to have to ask.
The world's Leo Hornack there under London Bridge by the River Thames. Saturday night's attack in London is our top story today, and we'll probably continue to cover its aftermath through the rest of the week. But should we? Simon Jenkins is a columnist for The Guardian and Evening Standard in Britain. He says too much coverage plays into the attacker's plan.
I think the thing to keep always in mind is what they want you to do, and they want you to publicize this to the maximum possible degree. You clearly can't suppress news, but that is no reason for almost gloating over it, which I'm afraid is what we've been doing, I think, here. You just have to think to yourself, I do not want these people to become celebrities. They're dead. They want to be glorified in death in some way. Their supporters want to read all about it. Their supporters want you to make them out to be, in their eyes, heroes. And these are things you don't need to do to fulfill your obligation to give news.
So you believe publicity is precisely what groups like ISIS want. If you look at the coverage of the attacks in London on Saturday night, since Saturday, where have you seen excesses, and how has that coverage since Saturday aided and abetted terrorism?
Well, as with the previous rogue attack on Westminster Bridge, the newspapers and the media, the broadcast media, they did nothing for 2 or 3 days, absolutely nothing else. This morning on the BBC, dear old BBC, I could hear nothing other than news that was now 2 days old, other than sport and the weather. They were given some special treatment. It was just simply terrorism over and over and over again.
Are you saying, like, attacks like the one on Saturday night in London and Manchester and Nice last summer and a whole bunch of them, are you saying they're less important and politically significant than the media are making them out to be?
I don't know what their significance is, frankly. In the case of this knife attack on Saturday in London, people are knifed to death in London every week. We do not give them the publicity that we give these particular ones, largely because the people who do it claim to be divinely inspired. I don't see why we redefine a crime because the people committing it claim to be divinely inspired.
To be fair, though, it was way more than a knife attack. There was an attack with a truck, and terrorism is more politically significant than random acts of violence, people getting knifed wherever.
I don't know what you mean by politically significant. You're right. They want us to change the way in which we behave, which a gangland killing does not want us to do. That is different. But that doesn't mean we have to agree with them.
Well, politically significant because they have a motive, and that motive is, we hear from a lot of sources, they're really angry with what countries like the UK and the US have been doing to their lives in the Mideast, in Africa, in Asia.
Well, that is undoubtedly true, and to that extent, our foreign policy is a causal element in it. A lot of gangland violence is race-oriented, or it's claimed to be race-oriented. Yes, there's a political component to many crimes. The question is how we treat them in a free society, and I think we should treat them as crimes. We shouldn't accord them special political status.
Well, the media covers crimes by reporting on them. I know you're not saying the alternative is to ignore this stuff, but what is the alternative? What is the solution?
I think the media should report these crimes as crimes. I mean, there was a knife attack in London on Saturday night. I think there's probably 2 or 3 other knife attacks in London on Saturday night. Elsewhere in London, possibly more people were killed. I don't know the figures. There's no doubt that when the crime is so staged to be peculiarly horrific, as in the case of driving a truck through people, it is going to merit more attention than if it was just a knifing crime. All I'm saying is treat these as crimes, horrific crimes, yes, But devoting your entire news agenda to them for 2 days afterwards, I think, is excessive.
If the media were to do it right in the way that you see is right, don't you think there's a risk of self-censorship?
Well, it's not a risk of self-censorship. I'm suggesting self-censorship. We adhere to all kinds of censorship all the time. We are told we can't commit contempt of court in this country. We can't break various rules on naming defendants. There are all kinds of rules that we have to accept. I'm just suggesting another rule, which is that we self-consciously do not exaggerate or gloat over or reiterate ghoulish clips on film more than someone would consider reasonable. I have to say, it's not the first time I've said this, I get a tremendous response from people who say that they agree with me to this. I just don't think I'm alone. It's just very difficult for journalists, including myself, inculcated to treat all these maxims, if it bleeds, it leads, dead bodies sell newspapers, all these phrases, which are sort of dinned into us from our youth. It's difficult for us to set them aside because there is a greater cause in these cases, which is the cause of not publicizing acts of terror.
Simon Jenkins there. He writes for The Guardian and The Evening Standard in London. Before we take a short break, a personal story from Saturday night from Malik Ramadan, a surgeon. He's also the Divisional Director of Emergency Care and Trauma at the Royal London Hospital. He was at work on Saturday prior to the London Bridge attack.
Well, I'd finished my shift and was cycling home.
And as he rode his bike, Ramadan had no idea of the tragic events unfolding not far away.
Actually, at the time of the attacks, I was completely oblivious. And as I got to the Old Kent Road, a large number of police vehicles came whizzing past, more than I've seen before, and I thought that's a bit unusual. And given what's been happening, I thought I'd better go back to work.
Ramadan says the Royal London Hospital and others have what's called a major incident plan. So off-duty doctors, nurses and support staff quickly returned to the hospital. And then the first casualties started arriving.
We got 12 patients, and I should say my thoughts are with both the victims and the families, but the 12 were all very badly injured. So the people who'd been stabbed had been stabbed with a clear intent to kill. The people who had been hit by what I now know to be a van were badly injured.
Many of them couldn't even speak.
People who'd gone through an experience more horrific than I can imagine, who were just sitting on trolleys not speaking to us.
Ramadan says that in the moment, as a medical professional, you have to forget about the horror. Instead, he says you focus on the task at hand, triage. But he expects his staff will be dealing with the trauma in coming weeks.
We're going to be thinking about staff this week who maybe have not experienced this sort of thing before and what support we need to offer to them, as well as the support we need to offer to the victims and their families.
For London, this is the third attack in just the last 3 months, and Ramadan says it's changed the way he and other doctors spend their off hours.
Given what's been happening, maybe what you'd normally do on a Saturday night is not what people are doing just at the moment. We have a major incident plan that involves people who are volunteers coming in, and I think that has focused people's mind a little bit on some of what they might need to do.
Dr. Malik Ramadan there in London, speaking with our colleagues at the BBC. Coming up on The World, Wonder Woman breaks superhero stereotypes and global box office records. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Greece is known for its olives and olive oil, but Greece is also in a deep economic crisis, and that makes it tough for olive oil producers to succeed there right now. Here's Daniela Cheslow with the story of how an international competition in New York is helping one Greek olive farmer.
You might be surprised at what you can taste in one sip of high-grade olive oil.
Tomato, then we have some citrus.
Almond, bitter almond.
There's some green banana, fava bean.
I'm at the New York International Olive Oil Competition. 15 judges are sampling oil out of cobalt blue glasses. The man running this competition is Curtis Cord.
So what you have here is Northern Hemisphere Organic Monovarietal.
He started the competition 5 years ago, inspired by olive oil he tasted while traveling in southern France. This year, more than 900 samples were submitted from 27 countries. Hundreds of them will go home with gold or silver medals. And it can boost business, so the competition is fierce. Curtis says it's especially tough for the producers in Greece. They tend to have small farms, and the producers don't get much help from their government, which is broke. Last year, Curtis says he got 180 Greek olive oil entries, but only 20 earned medals.
Imagine 20,000 olive trees, how you will catch all of them.
I met Mirta Kalampoka last year on the Greek island of Lesbos, a few months before her olive harvest. She showed me the trees she inherited from her mother and the workshop she built herself. Mirta and her husband Nikos bottle and label the olive oil here.
Like you're a child, you must get dressed nicely. You don't go out naked.
They were working as teachers and earning some money on the side from their olive oil when the Greek economy crashed in 2008. Mirta says the government cut their salaries in half. Like most Greek producers, she sold her olive oil cheaply to Italian importers. When the economy tanked, she thought she might have to sell off her trees. Then she got an idea watching the Italian boats come in.
All the boats coming from Italy with big containers and transport our gold liquid in their tanks to their country.
She thought, why not bottle her own oil and sell it at a premium?
Make it in a very nice bottles and sell it 50 euro per liter, maybe 100 euro per liter.
She started picking the olives earlier and pressing them into a peppery oil that she exported to specialty shops in Europe. And it was a hit. Awards cover a wall of her workshop.
From Japan, China, France. From
between the oil and a little guest house they set up for tourists, Mirta and Nikos were able to weather the financial crash. But then came the refugee crisis, with thousands of Syrians landing on Lesbos. Tourism plummeted. Mirta is hoping to get new customers in the U.S. She entered the New York competition in 2015 and won a gold medal. And she tried again this year. At the awards ceremony, judges, importers, and foodies sip glasses of this year's prize winners. I spot Mirta's oil in a tall, round bottle. An oil expert named Nick Coleman gives it a taste.
Clean, grassy, bitter, very peppery in the throat. All high-quality signs of a well-produced oil.
From Italy, Giuseppe Delecce.
Finally, Curtis announces the awards. Mirta wins a silver medal, but she isn't here to collect her trophy. So I call her on Skype. She's a little disappointed.
I don't think I was a good judge, but that.
But even a silver recognition here could help Mirta get noticed in America. Mirta says she's grateful to make a living at a time when so many other Greeks have no salary at all.
What we have is only the quality of our olive oil. If it was not that, I couldn't stay in Greece.
For the world, Daniela Cheslow, New York.
And speaking of Greece, it was a pretty good weekend for a certain young woman with roots in Greek mythology.
Who's this young woman? She's my,
Diana, Princess of the Mist.
Prince, Diana Prince.
Wonder Woman, the Hollywood version, smashed box office records over the past few days. And to celebrate the movie's release, the Alamo Drafthouse, a movie chain based in Texas, hosted a screening just for women. Anna Leskowitz noticed the reaction. She covers pop culture for the New Statesman in London.
So they announced these women-only screenings, and there was quite a lot of backlash to that from male cinema-goers who felt that it was excluding men from enjoying the movie. But what struck me about it is that we have seen women-only screenings happen historically, and there's been a lot less controversy and a lot less backlash to them.
Yeah, right. So you dug into other similar screenings, all women audiences, like in London from the 1960s to the 1980s. What were those about?
Yeah, so there was one in 1984 at the Ritzy in Brixton, which is still a very popular cinema here. It's a picture house cinema now, of Supergirl, which was interesting to me because there's obviously quite a lot of parallels between these two female-fronted superhero movies in this genre that's traditionally very male-oriented. And I think that was just intentionally a space for women and feminists to go and watch the film and share their thoughts on it.
What kind of reaction was there from the male public, for example, or the greater public, when a Supergirl was screened at the Ritzy?
An academic in the UK called Charlotte Brunsdon has written about it, and she describes just this very enthusiastic atmosphere. There was a band of all women a cappella singers, and she said, you know, people were cheering in the aisles, but there's very little reporting of any sort of male reaction to it at all. So it seems from that to me that it was a much less of a big deal.
What do you think changed from that screening where there was no backlash, as far as we can tell, to right now, where there was a lot of people who were upset.
Well, I think one thing might be that these are quite small women-run and women-organized events in the 80s, and the lack of the internet means that there are less people who are going to know about it and be outraged because they're not going to see it advertised towards them. And I think also that there's just perhaps more of a culture now where we have like such a heightened awareness of the concept of safe spaces, etc., that people are perhaps more likely to become annoyed by things like this that they see, because they see it as part of more of a general political correctness culture.
You've seen Wonder Woman, right?
I have seen Wonder Woman, yeah.
Where did you see it?
I saw it in a cinema, just a small chain cinema in London.
Right, so mixed audience. I'm just
mixed
curious.
Audience, yeah. One thing I really liked about my screening was how many kids that were there, and there were a lot of girls there. And when the film finished, I saw these young girls kind of like jumping off the stairs, you know, crossing their arms in front of them like Wonder Woman does with her kind of armor on her wrists. And I don't know, that was really heartening to me to see these kids, you know, clearly so influenced by what they'd just seen on screen.
Do you think your appreciation of it would have been different or maybe more empowering in some way if you had been with an all-female audience?
It's so hard to say, isn't it? Because I think sometimes it's not necessarily about it being like an all-female audience and there being no men there, but it's about creating an atmosphere in which women feel very like encouraged to respond to the movie that they're watching in that way. So it's, for me, it's less about excluding men than it's about encouraging women. And I think that was certainly happening at the screening I was at. And that's one of the great things about this film, is that it's obviously trying to do that deliberately with its audience.
Anna Leskowitz with the New Statesman there talking about the new Wonder Woman movie. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, using a 3D printer to craft the perfect turtle egg.
A turtle egg, it's white and the shell is white, but has a little bit of a yellow glow almost to it from the yolk inside.
But these eggs also have GPS trackers inside them, and poachers in Nicaragua better beware. That's still ahead right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Since the attack in London on Saturday night, President Trump has had a lot to say about it on Twitter, including this thought: we must stop being politically correct and get down to the business of security for our people. Trump tweeted that yesterday. It made us think about the people who carry out a president's policies and how Trump has yet to fill hundreds of key positions in his administration. And that includes posts that deal directly with counterterrorism. We asked Juliette Kayyem what impact those vacancies might have on security. Kayyem served at the Department of Homeland Security under President Obama.
It means that the Trump administration does not have the people it would want in those agencies, people that might reflect a Trump doctrine or Trump policies. And so those positions now are filled by career civil servants who certainly know the agencies and know how to run government, but certainly do not have the stature of representing the White House or the President of the United States. And so this idea that there's obstruction or the Democrats are not letting his nominees through is just not true. I mean, the 442 of these positions, senior positions, there's not even a name that the Senate can actually confirm.
Does the Trump administration plan on filling these vacancies or reorganizing, eliminating some of the positions, or just carrying on with the career people who are in place?
Look, this is a philosophy of governance that we've never seen before. And some of it comes from an attitude that maybe there's too much government. So, for example, Secretary Tillerson at the State Department is actually trying to reform the position so that there's fewer political positions to fill. But I think it gives them too much credit to say that there's an ideology or a philosophy behind this. This is an administration that has yet to get out of the pre-transition phase. I mean, you know, we are far enough along that the idea that the Trump team did not know that they were going to win the presidency is no longer an excuse. But I'll tell you, the irony of this is, of course, the exact opposite of what the Trump administration would want. you know, they wanted their people in to be disruptive and break up government. But the truth is, these long-term civil servants, the ones who used to work for me, the people who are in government a long time, these are the ones now running government, right? And they reflect the institutional priorities much more so than the Trump White House. There's an irony in all of this, that Trump may find it more difficult to get whatever agenda he wants to push through with a civil servant staff that's running these key positions.
Yeah, so Trump has talked about counterterrorism going down the road, but what can he actually do as long as he's got these 450-some vacancies?
You know, basically, it's just vetting people and putting names forward. That would be the first thing that is sort of required of a White House, and their incapacity to do that says something about their management style, but it probably says something else. And that is, they are finding it hard to have people enter as political appointees into this administration. This is a president whose polling is below 40%, who has a major investigation of potentially criminal magnitude hanging over him. And if you're a 40-something Republican who has a nice career, you know, the idea of going in as an assistant secretary at the State Department right now versus waiting it out is a easy question.
How confident are you that the counterterrorism team that is in place can deter or thwart any potential attack?
I think these questions sort of require me to separate Trump and the White House from the sort of operations and career folks who are working hand in hand with our NATO allies or Great Britain. I'm confident that those relationships amongst people who have worked for decades together remain strong. They may be frayed from time to time. But I'm not so confident in the behavior of our president to maintain goodwill amongst our allies, to not go after London's mayor after a terrorist attack. I'm less confident in that. So in the short term, it may be that we're just fine. But in the long term, I can't imagine that Trump's behavior, even after a terror attack in another country, won't have an impact on other nations' willingness to share information or keep relations up. I think our career people are trying to explain or explain away some of the tweets and some of the statements by President Trump. Keep your head down, keep focus on the long-term mission, and move forward. That is something that they've done through other crises or tensions and even political ones. I think the question is how long that can sustain itself.
That's Juliette Kayyem, a former official at the Department of Homeland Security under President Obama. Juliette, always good to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
The question is, how do you address extremism in the broadest context in a way that will actually make people feel safer when they go to a concert or they're walking across a bridge or they're in a street fair someplace?
That's Christopher Dickey, world news editor for The Daily Beast. He's been looking into that question following recent terrorist attacks in cities including Berlin, Stockholm, Manchester, and of course London this weekend. We'll hear more from Christopher in a moment. First, though, here's some of what British Prime Minister Theresa May has been saying since Saturday's attack about how she wants to counter extremism, and it includes eradicating what she calls the evil ideology of Islamist extremism.
It will only be defeated when we turn people's minds away from this violence and make them understand that our values, pluralistic British values, are superior to anything offered by the preachers and supporters of hate.
That's a bold ideal. That's great as an election year or election campaign remark, but it doesn't really make people safer. And when you're talking about the broad ideological questions, those are not going to affect very quickly the actual safety of people on the streets. That is going to take a whole different approach because fighting terrorism is multi-layered. Part of it is the ideological battle of against extremism, which the West has been very poor at fighting. But part of it is intelligence work in a broad sense in terms of surveillance and penetration with informers and with police agents. And part of it is last-ditch defensive measures in places that are likely to be targets. So all of those things have to take place at the same time.
I mean, in the short term, to interrupt recruitment and radicalization, Prime Minister May mentioned in her comments the need for the UK to take a really deep dive into regulating the online space where she says recruitment happens. What do you think is the most important thing that can be done in the short term?
I think in the short term, we have to understand that the intelligence services, domestic and international, do have to conduct a lot of surveillance. They are going to have to look very closely at the communications of lots of people. If you look, for instance, at the way the Israelis have been fighting terrorists over the last several years, one of the things they do is to data mine social media in order to find what people are saying and to focus in on certain actors, and then they arrest them preemptively. Now, we probably will all worry about whether we have to look over our shoulder to see whether the government is spying on us, but we have to hope that the government is spying on enough of the right people to keep terrorist attacks from happening. That's one part of it. Second part of it is that we have to reorganize the defenses around what are likely targets. You know, when you have a big event that is a possible terrorist to target, and we have to take into account that now that almost any big event, any place where there's a crowd could be a terrorist target, then you have to do something more than have one guy standing with a metal detector at the door. Because among other things, that just creates a long line, and the line itself becomes the target.
Right.
So essentially what it means is you have to have more undercover security and police officers working the crowd and looking at the scene, aware of the kinds of tells that even the most poker-faced terrorist might have. It's basically one of the things that the Israelis do. And while the Israelis may not have succeeded, in fact, I would say have not succeeded, in addressing the overall ideological and religious and cultural problems, they have become very good at addressing the short-term security issues that surround any particular events or locations.
As for the rest of us who are not used to those Israeli kind of methods, as far as privacy and free movement, you think we're just going to have to deal with it for the short term?
I think we're going to have to deal with it in the medium term. I don't think it's going to go away quickly. One of the dangers, though, is that governments, once they get accustomed to this kind of power, this kind of invasiveness, are very reluctant to give it up. And so we have to guard our freedoms, but we have to understand that for a certain time, we're going to have to compromise them as well.
Christopher Dickey is world news editor for The Daily Beast. He was speaking with us from Paris. This morning, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, on the road in Australia, had a crisis on his hands. Some of America's staunchest allies in the Arab world were having a major falling out.
We certainly would encourage the parties to sit down together and address these differences. If there's any role that we can play in terms of helping them address those, we think it is important that the GCC remain unified.
The GCC, or the Gulf Cooperation Council, is a group of Arab countries, including Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. And the country that's on the outs is Qatar, where the U.S. has its largest air base in the Middle East. Borzu Daragahi is covering this from Istanbul. So you wrote about all this today for BuzzFeed, Borzu. Give us the overview. Why is Qatar on the outs with Saudi Arabia and the UAE?
Well, there's been tensions between Qatar and much of the rest of the Gulf states for years now. These tensions have come to a head. What you see now is the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia spearheading an effort to really tighten the noose on Qatar and get it to capitulate on a number of regional issues, a number of ideological issues, a number of security matters. The risk is this could badly backfire. This is a big gamble on the part of Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
So there's been this growing suspicion, as you say, from Saudi Arabia and the UAE. What is that suspicion about Qatar been about? What are they worried about?
I would say it's less a suspicion than a series of accusations. And the accusations include the support that Qatar provides for the Muslim Brotherhood and affiliated organizations, which find refuge often in Qatar. Certain clergy, certain officials, certain members of the Muslim Brotherhood. It includes very good ties that Qatar has with Hamas, the Palestinian resistance organization controlling the Gaza Strip. It includes friendly relations that Qatar has with Iran and Hezbollah. And there's also an accusation, has not been substantiated, that Qatar is supporting militant groups that include the Houthis in Yemen, fighting the UN-backed government in Yemen, and also militants in the country of Bahrain, as well as in eastern Saudi Arabia province of Qatif.
So this sounds like this classic divide between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Saudi Arabia sees Qatar as kind of a proxy of Iran at this point?
That's a good question. It's a really interesting question, and it gets at the heart of what's going on here. I want to talk a little bit about just how severe some of the things that they're talking about are. They're basically talking about imposing a sort of blockade on Qatar. They're talking about blocking all land and air and sea access to Qatar from their shores. They're talking about expelling within 14 days, not just diplomats, but ordinary Qatari people from Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. These are very extreme measures that, you know, even countries at war sometimes don't do to each other. I talked to other people who are saying this could very well force Qatar into the arms of Iran or Turkey or Russia. And that would be really bad blowback for the UAE and Saudi Arabia.
Well, and it's got to be perplexing and concerning for Washington because the U.S. has troops in Qatar. It's the biggest U.S. base in the region. Why do you think Saudi Arabia would compromise Washington with this move?
My sense is it's the UAE that's spearheading this. And Saudi Arabia is a lot more ambivalent about the Muslim Brotherhood component. As a matter of fact, to some extent, Saudi Arabia is partnered with the affiliates of the Muslim Brotherhood in Yemen. It's a very complicated puzzle, this whole picture of who's allied with who in the Middle East. You could draw diagrams and maps and charts, and you still won't be able to really understand what's happening.
So one thing, one part of this puzzle that some of our listeners will know is Al Jazeera, which is based in Qatar, and they've kind of been drawn into this whole brouhaha. What's going on there?
Well, Al Jazeera is widely accused of giving a platform to the Muslim Brotherhood and its affiliates in the region. And, you know, sometimes you got to admit, it does seem to be very pro-Brotherhood in its coverage and in its slant. But it's also, you know, one of the most lively news channels in the region. And it gives, you know, coverage to populist and popular movements that are going on, including, for example, weird stuff like environmental activism in Algeria or protests in rural Morocco. So I think their agenda is a lot more complicated than some make out. But the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood gets a pan-Arab platform through Al Jazeera makes the rulers in the region who are hostile to the Muslim Brotherhood very angry about Al Jazeera.
Borzu Dargahi with BuzzFeed speaking with us from Istanbul. Thanks very much, Borzu.
It's been a pleasure.
We spent much of the show today talking about one story and the many important issues that it raises, that terror attack in London on Saturday night. That leaves less room for other stories from around the globe, but here are a few of them. India today launched its most powerful space rocket ever. Their mission control tracked it, tracked the rocket as it lifted off from southern India.
0, +1, +2.
S-200 igniter, vehicle liftoff.
+4, +5, +6, +7.
Later, the rocket successfully put a communication satellite into orbit, but the hope is that one day this kind of rocket will carry an Indian astronaut to space, and that India can eventually become a bigger player in the space industry. Also today, California Governor Jerry Brown was in Nanjing, China. He spoke at an environmental conference just days after President Trump decided to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement. Brown told the conference that his state will not be following Trump's lead.
California is all in, 100%, in meeting the Paris agreements, in fact, going beyond. And we only make it, we only do that if we can work with China, Chinese provinces, to get the job done.
Brown wants California and China to work together to lower carbon emissions on both sides of the Pacific. And one more quick news update. There were local elections in Mexico this weekend. The biggest one was in the state of Mexico, just outside Mexico City. It looks like the ruling PRI party of President Enrique Peña Nieto narrowly won the race for governor there. But that slim margin and close calls in other states don't bode well for the PRI. The party is facing an uphill battle to retain the presidency next year amid widespread anger in Mexico over corruption scandals and rising crime. Finally today, sea turtles. From July to January, hundreds of thousands of them nest in Nicaragua. It is an amazing sight. It's also an opportunity for a thriving criminal enterprise. Poachers steal the eggs, which are sold as food or aphrodisiacs. But conservationists are on the case. The World's Sarah Birnbaum went to Nicaragua to investigate.
Sometimes, brilliant ideas come from the most unlikely of places. For biologist Kim Williams-Guillen, it was watching TV. The AMC show Breaking Bad, to be exact.
In one of the later seasons, the protagonist of that show is in cahoots with a woman from a chemical company, and the law enforcement is looking for them, and they put a GPS transmitter on a barrel of chemicals that they were going to steal.
The woman from the chemical company spots the GPS tracker as they're moving the barrel with the forklift.
Wait, stop! Oh my God.
What?
Please tell me that's not what I think it is.
A short time after seeing the episode, Kim had an epiphany.
I was walking along, and it was just an aha moment. So I stopped and called my boss immediately and left her this very long-winded, breathless message where I was like, oh, I have the idea.
The idea? If the DEA could use GPS trackers to catch drug dealers, then Kim could use GPS trackers to catch wildlife poachers. She'd make a fake turtle egg, put the GPS tracker inside, and then she'd put the fake egg in a turtle nest. The poachers would steal it, and then Kim would be able to track where the eggs were going and who's involved in the trade. Kim's environmental group, Paso Pacifico, has tried everything to stop poaching on the local level. They've tried education. They've tried giving the communities more money so they won't have to turn to poaching. But Kim says they won't solve the problem if they don't catch the culprits at the top who are making the big money. And that's where the fake turtle eggs come in.
Let's go upstairs to my room, which is
Kim makes the eggs herself on a 3D printer from her home in Ann Arbor, Michigan. The printer is on a sewing table in the corner of the room. A watercolor of a turtle wearing a bow tie and a fez hangs on the wall. And scattered all around Kim are tools of the trade.
Like, these are the BBs that I use to add a little extra weight to the eggs.
The project has funding from USAID, and Kim says it's taken over her life.
Fortunately, I kind of take after my dad a little bit. He's one of those, like, real, like, engineering brains and fixed everything in our house. So.
She switches on the 3D printer and begins making the plastic egg. Once it's finished, the egg looks like a ping pong ball with a dimple in it. It feels kind of leathery, and it's squishy, just like a real turtle egg, so I'm told. Kim even turned to a prop designer in L.A. to help get the texture and the color just right.
It's white, and the shell is white, but it has a little bit of a yellow glow almost.
Once the egg is done, Kim inserts a tiny GPS transmitter, sands the egg, paints it, seals it, and it's ready to go. All I have to do is insert a SIM card for tracking purposes and power the egg up. And I say I because Kim drafted me into this enterprise. She's asked me to put a GPS egg into a turtle nest. So here I am. I'm in Nicaragua on the coast of the Pacific Ocean. It's about 10 o'clock at night. It's pitch dark outside. The egg is in my backpack. And Kim should be tracking me on her computer at home from the cell signal, if there is a cell signal. I'm hiking through the woods. And at the end of this walk, there should be a beach. I make it out of the woods into a deserted, solitary beach, and I meet up with two rangers who've been trained by Kim's conservation group to guard the beach from poachers. I turn off my flashlight, and I scan the surf in the dark for the silhouettes of nesting turtles. They're supposed to look like big boulders in the water from this distance. The rangers trade ghost stories to pass the time. I settle down in the sand to wait. And wait. Oh, wait, there's one! There! No, that's a rock. Sorry. Yeah, I don't find anything. It turns out I'm lousy at this job. I email Kim the next morning and tell her the bad news. She writes back she's not too surprised. After all, this is a little early for sea turtles. They nest in earnest in July. Over the next 6 months, Kim's group hopes to deploy hundreds of fake eggs. They plan to get tourists and locals to plant them. Maybe it's just as well that I'm not the only one doing this. Breaking Bad gives me nightmares anyway. For The World, Sarah Birnbaum, La Flor, Nicaragua.
You can see pictures of the fake egg and some pretty cute videos of baby turtles over at PRI.org. From the very real Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us. We're back with you here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.